there's generally two modes of people you find in the world. There's the people who play offense every day, and there's the people who play defense every day.
Jack Abraham, early investor in iconic tech companies like Postmates, Pinterest, and Uber. Jack has co-founded over a dozen companies, including Replicant, OpenStore, and Hims & Hers, which became one of the fastest growing multi-billion dollar public companies in history.
One of the smartest things that I did in the process of starting Atomic is we did a crawl, walk, run.
What is your process for filtering through your ideas?
It's much better to try to develop companies around observed pains in the world versus contrived ideas.
How do you master your time?
I once had this conversation with Marc Andreessen about Peter Thiel. Peter did all these incredible things in his life. It led to an hour meeting with Mark Zuckerberg, and that made everything else pale in comparison. You can get these power hours out of your time and out of your day and out of your life that could be worth more than the cumulative sum of everything else, every other way that you've spent time.
What does your next level look like? What is up, guys? Welcome back to the World Class Podcast. Today, I sit down with legendary entrepreneur and investor, Jack Abraham. Jack has co-founded more than a dozen companies, including Replicant, OpenStore, and Hims & Hers, which became one of the fastest growing multi-billion dollar public companies in history. Jack is also the founder and managing partner at Atomic, which is a wildly successful venture capital studio. He's also an early investor in tech icons like Pinterest, Postmates, and Uber. And in this conversation, Jack really demystifies the process of turning an idea into a massively successful company. So without further ado, let's dive in. Jack, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited, man. When I think of you, this is a random comparison, but I think of you as the Snoop Dogg of entrepreneurship.
I haven't heard of that one before.
I'll tell you why. Dr. Dre said Snoop Dogg was the first rapper to make being a gangster look easy.
Okay.
And I feel like you just make being an entrepreneur look easy.
Okay.
And we know it's not, but you just have this, I mean, you've built dozens of companies now. You've invested in Pinterest, Uber, early investor at those companies. You've pioneered a venture studio. You've taken Hims & Hers to a multi-billion dollar company. So you've clearly found a pattern of what works and what's successful. And it seems easy. So I'm excited to demystify it because we know it's not. But before we get into the strategies and tactics, I'd love to just get a little context. Like what were the pivotal conditions, circumstances, events just early on in your life that you feel like started to mold you as an entrepreneur?
I've always been the kind of person that's wanted to have a lot of impact. I think people are capable of achieving really great things. And I had this observation when I was younger that there's just so many talented people in the world that have so many gifts. And there's still so much that's broken in the world and so many problems that exist. And, you know, commonly in society, the way that's solved is those problems collide with people in almost like a random process. They'll get together, they'll try to fix the problem, and that's how the world works and that's how it improves. And I always thought, well, but aren't there all these problems that people don't necessarily discover, or they're not able to validate, or they're stuck somewhere in some sort of other path? And what if you just, shouldn't there be something in society that exists that pulls all of those people and the great ideas and opportunities together to unlock things that can make a big impact? And I never thought necessarily that I would be involved in that. I just thought that should be something that exists. That's really important. And if someone could build that, that'd be a really important thing. So I kind of parked that in the back of my brain. I was very fortunate to grow up in an entrepreneurial household. My dad came to the US without a dollar to his name to get a PhD in MIT, slept on a concrete basement floor in a sleeping bag, kind of a story, got into business, was promoted to run a company, and then decided to go start a company. And I saw that growing up. He had some success with it. When I was 12 or 13, he came to me and said, "Hey, Jack, I'm going to start a company that measures everything everyone does on the internet. Do you want to be a part of it?" And I said, "Sure, Dad, you know, sign me up. That sounds
so
great."
You're 12 years old.
It's like 12 or 13.
So what were you qualified to do inside of his company at 12 or 13? What did you start doing?
Well, I was programming.
So you were already an engineer at that age. You started pretty early.
Self-taught. Yeah. Self-taught. I mean, there weren't really many courses at that point doing that. But yeah, it was very fun. I was a programmer. I recruited a bunch of my friends from my school.
bunch of your teenage friends?
Yeah, a bunch of my teenage friends. And we were programming. And I fell in love with data and the internet and what was possible with it. I saw how small teams can come together in a short period of time and transform everything. It was really inspiring. And ever since then, I've been an entrepreneur. And it's been a great journey so far. And there's a lot more to come.
So you were 12, 13, you started programming, you started working at your dad's company as your first industry exposure. How did you go about learning? I feel like a lot of times as we get older, we get less resourceful almost to an extent because we have so many blockades. But like, what was your process for learning? Was it seeking mentorship up in the company? Was it just reading books? Or like, how did you get your skill set to a level where you could contribute?
I do read a lot. It's pretty amazing how much of all of human knowledge is available somewhere to read. That being said, I've always found the best way to learn is through conversations with really smart people. So I sought out mentors pretty early in my development, I guess. You know, I went to Wharton undergrad, for example, and they would always have some of the best alumni entrepreneurs come to campus and you could sign up to get a slot. And every time that was released, I was there, you know, immediately when the slots were released, and I would grab a slot and I'd just come with tons and tons of questions. I'd reach out to people when I was in college and play the student card of, hey, you know, I'm a student. I'm so interested in what you're doing. Do you mind if I can talk to you? And I find that that ability to have back and forth and dialogue is really important. When I started my first company after dropping out of college, moving out to the West Coast, I started a company called Milo. One of the smartest things I did as a part of the seed round to that company was I met Keith Rabois. There's a really funny story about our whole, you know, interaction and how we got to know each other. Long story short, he wouldn't meet with me. I was very, very persistent. I finally met up with him, and within 5 minutes, he said he wanted to invest in my company, which was an incredible
experience. Keith is known for that too. Like, he said he cut Brian Chesky a check in 5 minutes. Like, he just has that intuitive sense. So how did that back up a little bit there? Because I know at Wharton, you were at ComScore with your dad. You were starting some tinkering with some companies around 15. You ended up going to Wharton. Why did you drop out? Give us some background on the story about that process from dropping out, raising capital, like what happened there that led to Milo?
Yeah, so I kind of mentioned I was a little bit of a self-taught entrepreneur. So I figured, well, if I can balance out the technology that I know how to do with some sort of a business background, that would be really valuable. That's why I chose Wharton undergrad. And when I went there at first, I was like, I remember looking around the classroom freshman year, and I went to public school, and I was like, these kids are really smart. Oh my God. Like, this guy's like the smartest kid from this country, and this guy's the smartest kid. They were unbelievable. Most of them had gone to private school. And the first part of my college experience was, I need to beat all of them. I need to, like, I'm going to be perfect and I'm going to crush all of these people. Yeah. And I did. And I got like nearly a perfect GPA. And then once I was convinced, okay, great, like I can do that, I kind of was like bored. I was like, all right, like what's next? What's the next challenge? I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I was constantly thinking of ideas. I actually petitioned the school to do my own major in technological entrepreneurship, which gave me a lot more freedom in terms of the classes I chose. And I did an independent study with a professor of mine on different ideas to look into, at the end of which he actually offered me, through him and his investment partner, $500,000 to start Milo. And I just thought, you know what? You only live life once. And I do view risk a little bit differently than other people. Another way to view risk in that situation is like, what's the risk if you don't do this? Like, you might regret it for the rest of your life. Like, why not go take a chance? And there were a few things that were happening at that point. This was 2007, 2008. It seemed like there were clouds on the horizon economically. If I had waited, one, I might not have been able to start this. I might not have been able to raise any capital.
Yep.
Someone could have ran with the idea. There's sort of all of those things. But let's say it failed. Like, you know, what's the worst case? You go back to college. College is a pretty good place. And you know what? Then you have on-campus recruiting and you've been like an entrepreneur and you've done all these exciting things. You can probably get an even better job. So I actually viewed it as like, wow, you actually have this great safety net to come back to if this doesn't work. Of course, I intended to succeed, but you know, that's a different way to view it that I think is helpful for some people. And luckily my parents were supportive. I'll never forget. I went to the kitchen one day and I just said, hey guys, like, I just want to let you know I'm dropping out of school and I'm moving to the West Coast to start a company.
Because most parents are like, no way you're doing that, right? But they were supportive. Yeah.
Well, my stepmom looked at me like I had three heads at first. And, you know, there are great opportunities at schools like that I could have pursued. But I just decided I wanted to do it and I did it. I just moved out there. I didn't know anybody at the time. I worked out of a motel room with my co-founder. We didn't know how to get space. We weren't integrated at all. And we kind of dropped in. And honestly, within a few years, we knew a ton of people. Like, we were very plugged in, and that was a special time for me in my life.
What was your mindset back then? Like, when you're 21, you drop out, you start Milo. Did you have this brazen confidence that you seem to have now? Like, were you just like one of those guys that had this insane sense of self-belief, or was it like, I think I can do this, I got to prove it to myself, but worst case, I'll figure it out? But did you have that initially, or I'm curious, like, how you began to cultivate that level of certainty to go out and make these bigger bets?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think when it comes to entrepreneurship, there's like two bets you can make. You can make a bet on an idea specifically, or you can make a bet on yourself being an epic entrepreneur at some point. I was more making the latter of just, I believed in myself, and every good entrepreneur that I know and had gotten to know actually had some failures along the way. So yeah. Like, that's actually how you learn. You kind of have to put yourself into that seat. So I was very confident I'm going to be successful as an entrepreneur no matter what. And to me, the idea was really interesting, but a little bit secondary, which can be different for other people, and that can work as well. but I set out to do that. I would say, I mean, I put everything in. I slept on an arrow bed. One of my friends came and visited me one summer, and all I owned was an arrow bed, a bunch of black $1 t-shirts from Walmart, and boxers. Like, I bought tons of them because I never wanted to do laundry, and a lamp in the corner that they called Melty because it was like melting from IKEA. And that was all I owned. And I just slept, and I woke up, and I went downstairs, and I went and I did all of my work basically until 1 or 2 a.m. every day. And sometimes I would take Sundays off, but I just put everything into it. And, you know, sometimes I would wake up at 3 a.m. as the company scaled, and I'd just be like thinking about a problem, and I'd just go to the office and I'd just try to fix it. And that might not sound like a lot of fun to some people, but believe it or not, when you're in that moment, it's actually pretty fun. Yeah. It's invigorating. You're in it and you're doing it. And, you know, I had that chance, and people like Keith and Kevin and a lot of people at that point, to be able to work with people like that and have them bet on me was really special. And I definitely wasn't going to let them down, and I was going to do it. And I did it.
So this is interesting. So you're 21, you start Milo. I'm excited to dive into where you got the idea and how you did that. But you got some prolific investors at an early age before you were a acclaimed entrepreneur. There's a lot of lessons to be learned in this, I think. How did you convince Keith Raboy, who's a legend, how did you convince him to invest in you?
Yeah, so I mentioned when I moved out to Silicon Valley early on, I really didn't know anybody. I mean, my family was from the East Coast. I didn't know anybody. I just had one upperclassman because, again, I dropped out, who happened to work for Keith. And I knew Keith's amazing. I'd love to meet with Keith.
Yep.
So my friend tried to tee up an intro, and Keith responded that he would meet with me. And I said, when's a good time? And there was no response. I followed up, hey Keith, what's going on? You know, I'm going to be up near your office today. Like, I'd love to buy you a cup of coffee. No response. Finally, like, oh, let's meet this Sunday. You know, great. What time? No response. Eventually I nailed him down, and I went to the meeting, and I showed him the presentation. We went through it, and within 5 minutes he said he wanted to invest. I said, look, I'm actually not here to raise money. And he said, well, you're going to take my money because you're going to want to hire some engineers. And I want to introduce you to Kevin Hartz, who had founded Eventbrite, and John Kareem, the co-founder of YouTube. I said, well, that's not, you know, too bad. I'd love to meet those guys. And I went through with the introduction, and they all met with me. But back to the process of like how I think some of the ingredients that made me of who I am today, as a part, one of the smartest things I did in my whole life was, is a part of that deal. I said, I will give you guys this deal, this price, and this amount, but you each need to agree to meet with me for an hour every Friday for 3 years. And I got it in writing. And I took those meetings very seriously. I would come with, you know, pages and pages of questions. And it wasn't just about my business. It was also about just things I was wondering about venture capital and technology. And I learned so much from them. And now I feel privileged to, Keith and I started a company together here in Miami, Open Store, you know, unicorn company. It's doing super well, scaling really well. Kevin and I just started a company together called Soron, which everyone will be hearing more about. And it's just a privilege to continue working with them, some almost 15 years later.
That's incredible. So you were just extremely persistent, just to highlight this, extremely persistent. You just don't give up. Just keep pressing for the meeting. You know you want to meet them. And when you're there, you're in front of them. You give them a good presentation. You know your stuff, I imagine. Like, you've mapped out the plan, how you're going to do things. You impress the guy. And then you have the gall to say, yeah, I'll take your money. But basically, for me to be successful and make this what I need to be, I need your help. But they're happy to do it because you're like, hey, I want your partnership in this. And you basically were able to, you were able to get like an MBA every week from these guys, right? So a big theme for you is just getting in front of really smart people, being interested in them, building partnerships, and basically just collapsing time with borrowing knowledge from those guys.
Yeah. And I think maybe a word of advice to other entrepreneurs is like, preparation is so important for those things. I think they were probably pretty impressed with how prepared I came to every one of those meetings. I took them very seriously. I had outlines of things I wanted to get through and how I wanted to organize the time. I really had tremendous respect for their time. They're very, very busy people. And I think as a result, it kind of became fun for them because they got something out of the meeting too. And I think that's a key to this whole thing. I also think one of the things that's very special about the technology industry as a whole is there are these people who I describe as champions of the young, meaning like this is one of the few industries where the dropout from college can change everything. So people will pay attention to you when you're young and you can actually get a meeting with them, which is pretty cool. Some people do that more than others, and knowing who those people are when you're young and seeking them out and trying to get some time with them is really smart.
So you were at Milo for what, 3 years?
Three years.
Built that over the course of 3 years. You sold it for $75 million.
$75 million
to eBay. What did you learn throughout your time in building it? You're 21 years old. You have to hire executives that are probably twice your age. Like, what was the process of building Milo and what were some of the big takeaways?
Yeah, my co-founder and CTO was definitely a lot older than me. He was like in his 30s. And I just, again, was taking him out to dinners and lunches and wining and dining him. And he was really into poker. He was a really good poker player. And he used to play at the World Series of Poker. And he was kind of obsessed with that as like the ultimate competition. And I said to him at one point at one of these lunches, I said, consider this opportunity this, okay? You get to sit down at a poker table and just wait, see your hand, see the flop. If you don't like it, get up. Go run away. Go do something else. That's fine. If you don't like what you see on the flop, go do something else. And by the way, if you join me, I will pay for your buy-in to the World Series of Poker this year. And to me, that was a lot of money at the time.
What was the buy-in price?
$10,000 or something.
Right. And
you're a kid.
21.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
That was like a lot of the money I had.
But that was a bold move.
That was a bold move, but I did it. He said yes. He joined me. And yeah, we continued to hire amazing people. And for much of the company's history, maybe all of it, I was usually like the youngest person at the company, which is a little bit strange.
Yeah.
But yeah, we built it up. We had a blast doing it.
What was your superpower? Like, what were you focused on in the business? Because I think a big part of being successful and building a business is being aware of like what you're amazing at, tripling down on it, and then having enough awareness to surround yourself with the right people, to have a complete team. What were you doing at those companies and what were the things you had to kind of hire out for?
Early on, I was doing a little bit of everything. Yeah. I mean, I was up at 1 a.m. moving pixels around the screen and doing design work. I was doing some programming. I was doing hiring. I was doing business development. I mean, I was doing anything and everything to make the company successful. I would say at that stage in my life, I was a little bit more of like what I would describe as a micromanager. Every detail mattered and I was going to make it perfect. And I was determined to do that. And if someone else couldn't do it, I was going to do it. As I've grown and scaled in my thinking, I've realized that's not a scalable way to be. And by the way, one of the things that I've learned from being around so many amazing, smart people that have been so successful is actually the best way to work with really smart people is if you can create an environment of freedom and autonomy. Because the best people want freedom and autonomy. They don't want someone breathing down their neck and pushing pixels around the screen and editing the code live on the site and all of that stuff. So over time, I've become much more of a partner to people and working with them as a partner and giving them a lot of latitude and a long leash to to work together. And that was a journey I went on and I discovered through actually my time at eBay in an interesting way. And I've continued on that path. And that's kind of like the interesting paradox in some ways of our industry is like the very best people, they want freedom and autonomy. And if you can create an environment like that and work with them, that's nearly half the battle, if not more.
Wow. And so you were at eBay for, you sold to eBay. Mm-hmm. You were working with John Donahoe directly mm-hmm. there as well?
Yep. He became one of my mentors too. He then was the one who took the hour with me every week.
So he's the current CEO of Nike.
He's the CEO of Nike, correct.
What did you learn from him and working such close proximity with John?
John is, I'd say, absolutely incredible at things like people, organization. How do you make things function? How do you hold people accountable? How do you inspire people? How do you create an amazing culture in an organization? eBay was such a big company. I mean, it's hard to manage that many people. I had only managed, you know, like dozens of people up until that point in time.
Which is still a lot for a 24-year-old.
Which is still, and right. was a lot for me at that time, but it's a whole different thing to manage tens of thousands of people.
Right, yeah.
And I just learned about how different that was and the type of skill set it took to be successful at doing something like that. I'm really grateful for my time with John. He's absolutely a remarkable person, and he continues to do amazing things at huge companies. What he did at ServiceNow is amazing. What he's doing at Nike now is great. And, you know, he still invests in each of our funds, which is awesome. He's on our LPAC, which is essentially like our board of our fund. And it's a privilege to continue working with him.
That's amazing. So you were at eBay for 2 years after the acquisition. I'm imagining you realize that you're not really a big company guy. You're a builder.
Correct. Yeah.
So like, it was only a matter of time. What was the in between there? Like, you're at eBay. When did you start thinking about Atomic? How did that idea form? And what was that process from like leaving eBay to actually taking action and starting Atomic?
Yeah. So I've always considered myself a little bit of like a student of innovation and the innovative process.
Okay.
And I think Amazon is actually, somewhat ironically, you know, one of the companies that's the best in the world at this because yeah. they've been able to compete and build products, not just in one area of core competency, but in many, many areas. So I studied what they had figured out at Amazon. Like, what did Jeff Bezos figure out that made this possible? And he has this whole concept around two pizza teams, which is really interesting, which is no matter how big the idea could be, I mean, this could be like a huge idea. This could be AWS, you know, from the outset is what it looks like. The initial team that starts it can't be bigger than that with which could be fed by two pizzas. So think like 4 to 8 people you can take off the mothership. They can be allowed to innovate. They can move really quickly. They can have permission to do that and to fail. And then only once they have product market fit, then you put a lot of resources on them, capital, more people, resources from the company to let it scale up. And this is one of the reasons why I think founder-led companies tend to succeed more in the long term than non-founder-led companies, because founders understand this dynamic of how you actually create the next thing. Steve Jobs was really famous for this too. He would handpick the people that went and worked on the iPhone. So I thought, there's something to that. I'm at this big company now. Maybe I can convince John to let me do that. So I started building my own two pizza teams, and I built 6 of them.
So you were doing this inside of eBay?
Inside of
incubating eBay. New products?
Correct, okay. For the company. And a bunch of what we did hit and, you know, was driving, you know, press cycles. Some were driving the stock price. They were really exciting. The biggest thing I built, 130 million monthly active users were using at the time. We launched it in 13 countries in like 9 months.
Wow.
And that also enabled me to practice the style of working with people as opposed to micromanaging.
Interesting. So you were cutting your teeth there at eBay.
Starting to learn that.
But this was the kind of precursor of what would become Atomic.
Correct. at the same time, I had this crazy commute. I lived up in San Francisco. I'd commute down to San Jose every day. I was about like 2.5 hours in the car. My mind is always going on something, and I was generating new ideas for like, what's my next company going to be? By the time I was ready to leave eBay, I had a list of about 250 ideas for what my next company could be. And I put 2 and 2 together, which was to say, you know, look, if I can go build these two pizza teams at eBay where Nobody gets any upside if this works. Honestly, there's career downside. You have things working against you. There's bureaucracy. There's, you know, you can only use eBay's code. You can't use open source. You can't use APIs. You can only do things in commerce. What if you remove all of those constraints? You can work with anyone in the world, not just people at eBay. There's no limit to what you could do, theoretically. And they get a lot of upside. It seems like it should work even better than what I was doing at eBay. So I started with Atomic with my own capital in 2012. And then when I was convinced it was working, then we raised our first fund. And, you know, we've continued to double down on that. Now we're on our fourth fund, continuing to fund companies. And it's been a great journey.
So you guys, so you kind of pioneered this because no one had really accomplished this at scale, right? Where most venture capital firms, they invest in external companies. You said, we're going to invest in our own companies, build our own teams, get them to product market fit with our two pizza teams. And then we'll layer in, start bringing in executives to come in and actually scale them and basically just have a bunch of these horses racing in parallel, essentially, right? So what did you have to prove out initially as a bootstrapped entrepreneur here before you started taking funding?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'd say in some ways, attempting to do what I did, which I've now inspired a lot of people to do. There's something like 700 studio funds now. I mean, wow. We were the first ones to create that model. Think of how many companies that's created. That's a lot of impact. Going it back is. To, you know, what's interesting to me.
That is cool.
That being said, it's really hard. It's almost like I would describe it as masochistic in a way.
Why is that?
You and I know how hard it is to build one company, and I described a little bit of my journey building my first company. Once you start doing them in parallel, there is a lot of work. There is a lot going on.
Yeah.
I think one of the smartest things that I did in the process of starting Atomic is we did a crawl, walk, run. So the first year at Atomic, we only did one company. The next year, we did two companies. The next year, we did three. The next year, we did four. So slowly scaling it up. But what we tried to hold our bar to is the quality of every subsequent company needs to be at least as good as the prior one, if not better. And until we believe that that's the case, we have work to do. And we need to figure out processes and systems and ways to achieve that goal.
Yeah.
Quality over quantity is kind of like our mantra and how we consider things. And that's where I see a lot of people fail that try this model. You know, I had 250 ideas. I had access to capital. I had a lot of my own capital. Could have very easily tried 20 of them. That's like less than 10% of the 250. That is the path to failure. That is like, you know, you spread yourself too thin. You have a bunch of half-baked stuff. You try to bring it out to market. It needs more funding. The VCs are all like, this stuff isn't any good.
Yeah.
It trades down the brand. So it's really to do something like this, you have to have a long-term mindset to be very patient. You have to be very focused and you have to put a lot behind everything and you really have to make it work.
I want to demystify how you do this because I know there's probably a massive playbook you've iterated on for many years, but there's a lot of people listening that want to just start one successful company, right? They're ruminating on ideas, but they don't know which one to pick. They don't know how to test those ideas. They don't know how to figure out which ones to triple down on. Can you just share as tactfully as you can, like what is your process? I know you take like ideas down, I think in Evernote or just something where you're constantly, when inspiration strikes, you're writing down these ideas, but what is your process for filtering through your ideas, maybe even how you come up with them in the first place and actually selecting and investing your energy into those?
One of the things that I've reflected on, which is theoretically a problem with this model, is some of the best entrepreneurs, they experience a personal pain point and then they want to solve it.
Yeah.
Why is that a good way to start a company? You've observed a pain, you know the pain, and you have the way to solve it. So I actually think it's much better to try to develop companies around observed pains in the world versus contrived ideas. And it's very easy when you're doing this model to fall in the world of contrived ideas of, oh, well, we have this technology and we have this thing. And what if you did that here? And, you know, you have to be, I think you have to be really, really observant and acutely aware of everything all the time. I mean, I'll have some of my best ideas, you know, observing something from one of our companies or from a trip around the world somewhere or from a conversation with someone. But it's really looking for, what are those really big problems that exist? and those pain points and trying to solve them, as opposed to like invent a solution and then try to find a pain point, which I think is also a path that is not a good one to go down.
So you're just going through life and you have this kind of reticular activating system in your brain, just kind of programmed to just be observing, like, where are there inefficiencies? Where are the things that are broken? Mm-hmm. And you're kind of just taking inventory of those as you go about your life?
Yes. And as Atomic has scaled and we have more companies in more industries, I would say my eyesight, it has expanded.
Yeah, dramatically.
Because I can see in a lot of different industries and a lot of companies of a lot of different sizes and how they work and where they're broken. And it is a process. You can get better and better at it, and you can pattern recognition. Well, you know, that was broken over here in this industry.
Yeah.
There's some misaligned incentive here. It seems similar there. So it starts to become a little bit easier to find some of these patterns.
So now you've got your list of your observed problems, pain points in the world. You have this list. From there, how do you start testing and validating those?
Yeah, so it's not enough. I like to think it's not enough to look at the world or something in the world and say, there's a better way. Yeah. There's a lot of ways things could be better. Our view is it doesn't matter unless you can scale it. And there's so many ideas that you and I could have a conversation about, and we could say, hey, this is better. Like, this is how the world should be. That doesn't mean that's way the way the world will be. You need some vector to scale that idea into society in a massive way for it to have legs and be worth working on. There is a whole class of ideas, I'd say, that you're right. That's how the world should be. That should exist. But it kind of doesn't matter if you're doing it in an ivory tower. So we've engineered this whole system for thinking through not just, is this a good idea? Why or why not? Can we build a better solution to this thing? But is there a channel that we know how to operate that's very scalable to get this in the world? And that could be from sales teams. We'll pre-sell a lot of products before we build them. That's a good way to know. Okay, if we build this.
Sell it before you build it.
Correct.
With a wait list or something? Or how did you guys do that?
A lot of times it'll be through a simple like letter of intent or something like that. This is very early on. And part of this was inspired. I read Larry Ellison's biography. He was very famous about doing this at Oracle. So he would go and meet with customers and he would listen to their problems and almost pitch products before Oracle built them. He'd get customers sign up to do it and then he'd bring them back to the engineers and build them. And it's a really good way to know, okay, if I'm going to spend all this time and all of this energy building this thing, it's actually going to matter and people care about it.
Yeah.
So you can do that with sales. You can also do that with marketing. I mean, you can put products in front of consumers and build things like wait lists or bring them through checkout flows and get them to pre-buy things.
So this is great. So you're not going out and just trying to go build MVPs for 1,000 ideas, right? You're validating that the problem is real in the market and that there's actually customers that would buy it if you had the solution. And then after you validated interest in the market, then you're building.
Correct.
Okay. I'm following. That's a good distinction.
And part of the goal for Atomic has been, how do we invert the odds of startup success? So, you know, failure rates for startups are extraordinarily high.
What is it, 90-something percent?
Way above that. I think it's like extraordinarily 99. High. But if you really peel back the reasons, the number one reason is the common way to build a startup is you have an idea, you get some money, you take a year or two to build it, and then you hit this distribution wall and you can't get the product out into the world, and then the company fails because you don't have any more money. So if you can fast forward to that 2-year point and know, okay, this is going to be really worth building. If we do that, we can get to a really good point and scale something up. That can dramatically increase the odds of startups succeeding.
I want to get into this example in a little bit with Hims and Hers, but you've said before that distribution upfront is more important than product, right? Distribution is king to an extent. Can you define for the audience, like, what is distribution and what in your experience are like the most effective channels and ways that you create distribution to give you a asymmetric opportunity for success?
Yeah. Distribution is just another way of saying building something that you validated that people or companies really want and are willing to pay for. And they can pay for that in different ways. I mean, it could be money. In some cases, it could be their time, but they're giving something because you've created something of value. For products that you monetize early on, That's through either a sales team usually, or it's through marketing, or it's through some combination thereof. Mm-hmm. And since we've built so many companies and we know how to operate many channels in marketing, many channels in sales, we can go and activate testing those channels and try to see, is it something companies or people really want? Mm-hmm. Are they willing to pay for it? And is there enough that they're willing to pay for that you can pay to push the product through that channel? And I think that's an interesting way to go about it. It's worth noting there is another way to go about building companies that some very successful people have done, which is you go and you build something absolutely incredible that the world...
Like OpenAI.
Yes. Like I actually had a conversation with Sam about this like a week and a half ago at his house. Just, you know, I think the amazing thing about OpenAI is they went and they worked on it for a really long time and they built something so amazing that then the world talked about it. Yeah. And it just got distributed everywhere through essentially word of mouth and virality. That's absolutely your best case. If you can do that, you can build
that's
something.
That's like the hardest thing to do, right? Like the Henry Ford example where they wanted faster horses, he gave them the car.
It's literally the hardest thing in the world to do. And, you know, we will attempt some of those at some points as well. Right. However, that is like the double black diamond, I would describe it, of building startup companies. And if you can do it, it's amazing. But it's, you know, I always wanted to disclose.
Black diamond.
There's many ways to get
there's
to,
many ways to, be successful.
To a good outcome. We yeah. happen to have found one that I think is repeatable and scalable and can work in a fund model. And,
yeah.
you know, you can take some of these methodologies across a portfolio and blend them together and create good returns.
Yeah.
That's what we do.
I'm curious on how this works in your model specifically, because in startups and venture, we talk a lot about founder market fit, like the founder really having passion and the founders just with that impossible is nothing mindset driving towards success. But you have a small team often that you're a part of and leading where you're coming up with the idea, you're validating it, getting it to some semblance of product market fit, and then bringing in a CEO to run with your idea, right? But that's pretty different than most companies. CEOs might get layered in a lot later, but it's usually founder-led for a lot longer until it's a mature organization. And so how do you go about hiring the right CEO? Because it wasn't their idea. Like they didn't have it wasn't their brainchild, right? Which is typically what you think would be necessary to have that level of intensity and conviction. So how do you go out and find the right CEOs to then kind of adopt these brainchilds of yours and like take them to where you want them to go?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'd say, first of all, we do work with people sometimes at inception okay. on the ideas, and they really are the co-founder with us from day zero, like from the moment we start working on it. We work on it together with them. And that's worked, and that's built some really great companies for us. Sometimes, you know, Atomic's a bigger organization now. We're over 50 people. We have the ability to prototype a lot of things. We have the ability to try a lot of things. We're really good at this 0-to-1 process of figuring out if something has product market fit.
Uh-huh.
And if we're convinced, okay, this has product market fit, this can be a really big idea,
mm-hmm.
we'll bring someone in when it's still early enough that there's enough to go from there of like things to decide, how big this becomes, what the vision is,
yeah.
that this is the freedom and autonomy thing. This is really like turning over the keys to your baby and making it theirs. And they get to define everything and own the culture and own the direction. And it's still early enough. This is a very small company where they really are truly the co-founder, and we consider them our co-founder.
And you give them co-founder equity.
We give them co-founder equity, which is usually like as if they came in at day zero, they got half the company. So that's like a lot of equity that we give them, which is very unique, and not a lot of other people do that. But we recognize it's really difficult to build companies, and for amazing people, they should be equitized. Like that's how you build big companies. It's better to own you know, a smaller angle of slice of pie and build a bigger pie than yeah. just try to focus on, you know, having some big angle of a tiny tart pie. It just doesn't make, it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And when you start thinking that way in like a non-zero sum way, which yeah. is the kind of thinking that produces really big companies in our industry,
yeah.
that's when you really have the ability to build big things.
I would love to zoom in on some examples because you've done this with a lot of companies now. I know Replicant, Homebound, Bungalow, Open Store with Keith. It's having a ton of success. I think you're tell me if I'm wrong, but your biggest hit's been Hims and Hers.
Yeah, certainly by revenue, and you know, it, because it's a consumer product, everyone's seeing the ads. And
I mean, you guys took that to close to a $3 billion valuation within like 3-4 years or something. I think it, one of the fastest unicorns in history. Mm-hmm. So you guys clearly got something right there. If you were to dissect Hims and Hers and kind of just lay out, like, here are the couple of things that we really nailed that other people, not copy, but could emulate, what would you say those are?
I think it's always interesting to think about, there are a few things there. One is, if you take things people already want to do, or companies, and there's like a lot of steps and there's a lot of pain in going through the process, and you can remove the steps and you can remove the pain and you can make it really fast and really simple, that's a way to get a lot more of the behavior. And, you know, theoretically, technology should be able to make healthcare a lot better. It should be able to make it faster, cheaper, you know, help people wherever they are without having to call and get appointments and pay a lot of money and go to waiting rooms and go to Walgreens for half an hour and, you know, wait, and just the typical process. It's a lot. And that's why not a lot of people go through it. And I think that's part of the reason why the United States isn't a very healthy country, because like we're in the age of like Uber and Uber Eats, and, you know, like you press a button and a car shows up and food shows up. Should be the same for healthcare. And we had been ideating on that as a general concept. We've been looking into telemedicine, and I was actually an angel investor in a company called Doctor on Demand, which I consider, like Teladoc, to be like telemedicine 1.0, which is essentially, okay, let's create a doctor in the cloud. If you get sick, you call this doctor or you do a video chat with them and they prescribe something to you. That's how it commonly works. The problem with that is that's like a pretty infrequent pain in the consumer's mind of like, oh, I need to go to the doctor. Versus there are more persistent pains, like I'm suffering from this condition and I would like to get treatment for it. Those are more persistent. So we kind of inverted the model and we said, are there conditions that are persistent where you can help people solve those with telemedicine as a vehicle for the diagnosis? And instead of making money off that doctor visit, you make money off of the drug for the lifetime of the drug. And as you know, drug companies are really good. Pharmaceutical companies are great businesses. We're not a pharmaceutical company, but you know, if you can solve enduring problems for people for a long period of time, you've created a lot of value and you can capture a lot of value.
What did you observe with Hims and Hers was the big problem that needed to be solved?
The big problem is in the US, there are just so many people that are suffering from conditions that will, you know, the New York Times wrote this amazing article about men, like something like 40% of them won't go to the doctor because they don't want to be told anything's wrong with them. Like they'll only go if like they feel like they're dying. Or
they're
something.
Not wrong.
Yeah, this is a thing. Yeah. So if you can remove that friction and you can help get people treated and meet them where they're spending their time and make it easy, you can actually help treat a lot more people.
Especially with things with stigmas around them too.
That's absolutely correct. That's another reason why people don't go to the doctor. I mean, doctors are amazing. They're such an important part of our society. But sometimes they're judgmental, either perceived or actually. And that could cause people to not activate and not ever want to talk to them unless it's really, really serious. So you take away that stigma, that judgment in a digital platform. And I think that caused more people to raise their hands and say, okay, I would like to try this. I would like treatment. And, you know, if it works for them, that's amazing. And if it doesn't, it's pretty easy. They just, you know, they can go back to the way that they were. So it's kind of low cost for them to see if it works.
And you, back on the theme of distribution, which you guys nailed here, like, can you walk me through tactically how you kind of proved the demand for the products before they were built here and what that process looked like for Hims and Hers specifically?
Yeah. So we did a prototype of Hims and Hers before it was like even a product. It was under a different brand name. And we did advertisements for it to see, like, do people actually want this? Do they want it for different conditions? And hair loss tested absolutely off the charts. We had something like $1 million worth of demand, you know, in a very short period of time in the early days of the company's history that we couldn't fulfill at that time. But it showed us, wow, like there is a lot of demand here. We were floored. We just couldn't believe it.
And there wasn't like good hair loss solutions on the market, but men don't typically go to the doctor and advocate and say, hey, I got a problem. Like they want an easy solution where they can kind of do it in their own privacy. They don't want to tell all their friends about it and tweet it out. You know, like, so they just wanted an easier safer medium to get it, essentially.
Yeah, I was really shocked when we started the company that finasteride and midoxenil, the penetration in the U.S. was so low, and they were such effective drugs for hair loss, and they have very, very, very low side effects. I just couldn't believe it. And something like 50 million men that suffer from hair loss in the United States of some form, and you know, something like a thousandth of them were trying to get treated. It just seemed crazy. And these drugs aren't even that expensive. They were coming off of patent at the time. So there's an opportunity also to decrease the price, which also is an inhibiting factor for people getting treatment. And we just thought, people need to know about this. You know, clearly it's an issue. I think specifically with hair loss, there's a little bit of what I like to describe as the boiling of the frog problem, which is, it happens slowly. I mean, you're looking at yourself in the mirror every day, and the change day to day isn't, there's like not that moment where you're like, oh, I need to go do something about this. It's kind of like that
gradual,
dull, lagging pain, but yeah, like you kind of know you have to do it, but you're busy and you really don't want to go to the doctor. And like, you know, we can come to you and meet you where you are and say, hey, there's actually,
you remove that friction entirely and make it easy.
Make it super easy, and you can try it. And if it works for you, that's amazing. And then if not, the doctors will work with you and try to find something that does. And that's a really effective way to go about that. And we like multiplied the entire size of that market in terms of number of people.
So you found a clear need, and then it was an underserved market. Like Finasteride, those guys had great products, but they didn't have the distribution. They didn't penetrate from a marketing angle and meet the consumer where they were at.
Correct. Yes. I find that like the old, what I describe as the old way of health, this is, by the way, 99% of healthcare is still done.
Like, yeah.
Some pharma company spends hundreds of millions or billions of dollars building something, and then, you know, they go and they have to market it, and that's very expensive. And they literally market it through blunt instrument TV ads or like sending people into doctors' offices to talk to them. It's extraordinary. There's so much expense in that system. And we live in this amazing age where, you know, you can actually reach people where they're at and where they're spending their time. And if you can reduce a lot of the costs in that system, the other thing is you can afford to invest in more drugs and more therapies and more things that can help more people. So it's just a much more efficient way of going about it. And I think, I mean, we've seen it as a company of, you know, proud to say, like, as of this quarter, we passed, you know, the telemedicine 1.0 juggernaut Teladoc in terms of market cap, which is pretty cool. So I think that we were right in that insight of like telemedicine 2.0. This is how people want that future of healthcare to be.
Yeah.
And we're still continuing to scale it up, and has a lot of legs and room to go from here. There's a lot of sick people in the U.S. There are a lot of people that could use a lot of help, and we're happy to be able to serve them. Over a million at this point.
It's amazing. And you took that company public. What was that experience like for you?
Well, it occurred during the pandemic. So, we
couldn't
like,
even go.
Couldn't even go and like do the bell ringing. We did like a virtual bell ringing over Zoom, and the chief legal officer, her Zoom like failed a minute before we were supposed to go on. Yeah. So there were some issues like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, hopefully before too long, we'll be back to ring the bell on something else.
Did that feel like the Super Bowl for you? Like, because it's so hard. It's like you're just bleeding for your startup for a while. You're working nonstop. Did that give you the feeling you thought you would get when you went public?
I just felt like, not really, actually. You know, I was just more like, let's keep going. Like, let's keep doing this. This is exciting. Like, this is a milestone.
Yeah, let's celebrate quickly and keep going.
And maybe it felt a little more that way because it was just a Zoom and, you know, people weren't together in person. It's a different time.
Yeah.
But it was certainly an amazing milestone. Yeah. And it's been great to see what's happened since.
I want to dive into a little bit of tactics. Basically, how you do this stuff, you must be so good at managing your time. And I know you study your calendar, you have processes, tactics for how to maximize your time. I'm curious if you could share any tips for the audience on how do you master your time? What do you specifically do?
So one of the things that I've learned is that time is something that you always spend, but it has different outputs in terms of like magnitude of effect. So one way to think about time is like, you're going to spend it no matter what. How do you spend your time in the way that you can get the most output out of it? And I once had this conversation with Mark Andreessen. We were talking about Peter Thiel and what was going on with him. And there was this amazing thing where, you know, Peter did all these incredible things in his life. He's one of the most amazing people the planet has ever created in some ways in terms of his success and what he's been able to generate. And, there was one point in his life where it was like, I did all of these things. You know, I studied really hard. I got into Stanford. I got into Stanford Law. I went to the best law firm. I, you know, started a hedge fund. I met Max. PayPal was started. It merged with X and, you know, got this outcome. And I started this and all this stuff. And, you know, it led to an hour meeting with Mark Zuckerberg. And that, like, made everything else pale in comparison. Like, it's just like you can get these power hours out of your time and out of your day and out of your life that could be worth more than the cumulative sum of everything else, every other way that you've spent time. And once you realize that, you start looking at time a little bit differently of like, what are these power hours? How do you get more of them? How do you realize what is and what isn't a power hour? And I'm still on that journey. I think people should be on that journey their whole life. There are some hours and bits of time that you can spend that are worth maybe not more than the cumulative hours of your life, but maybe more than the last day or the last week or the last month. And training your brain to, I call them power hours. Look for those like power hours of time where you can spend time and you get a disproportionate outcome out of how you spent that time. And that could be different for different people. And part of that plays to your strengths and what you're really good at. But in order to really discover that, you have to really think about not just how you're spending your time right now, but how you've spent it in the past, and you have to analyze it. I used to take printouts of my calendar and I'd cross off the things that I did that I defined as like, if I hadn't done this, nothing would have changed. Like nothing, this didn't matter. Like I didn't need to do this. Someone else could have done this just as well as I did. And I try to cross them out and I try to delegate them or find someone else who is as good at as I was at those things and have them do those things. Try to really focus on the things that uniquely I can unlock as much as possible. And that's a continuing journey. That's going to keep going on, hopefully, for the rest of my life. And that's how you can, you know, achieve very, very high output for the limited input of the time we have in our lives.
That's brilliant. So number one is do a calendar audit and look at your whole calendar and say, what are the things that I did this past week that really didn't move the needle? They were just filling up space, or somebody else could have done them and it wouldn't have had a big impact. And number two is think about the big levers. Like, what are the opportunities for quantum leaps, right? Like, where are the biggest leverage? What is that big, bold action or that one person you could get in front of? Or maybe you could learn more from that one person in 1 hour than you could have learned in 10 years studying yourself. But like, what are those big quantum moves?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sort of learned like there's different hierarchies of how important things can be. Like, one of the highest leverage things you can do is hire someone who can raise capital for you. That's extremely high leverage. The second highest is raising capital yourself, because that buys the time of a lot of other people. The third highest leverage is hiring people who can hire for you. And then the fourth highest leverage is hiring people directly. And, you know, somewhere in there, it really depends on like the idea, but some ideas can be a breakthrough. That could be at the very top of that list, or could be in the mid, or could be at the bottom. But those are four dependable things that you can rely on that create a lot of output.
That's brilliant. If whoever's listening, go back and play that part back, because there is some gold there. I'm curious, you've worked with some of the most impressive founders in the world, right? Peter Thiel, John Donahoe, you know, Sam Altman. I'm curious, some of the best lessons in life are caught, not taught, just through osmosis of being around these people. I'm curious, for some of these people that have been impactful in your life, like, who were those big game changers for you in terms of mentors, and what were a few lessons that you took from them?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I'd say the good news is there are a lot of ways to achieve greatness, and different people have different styles for doing that. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting knowing enough of these people, because they've done it in slightly different ways, leveraging different strengths. And you can learn over time which of them apply to you and which of them do not apply to you. I'd say one commonality that I found across all of them is the desire to just do big and great things. You should just endeavor to do big and great things, because doing big and great things in some ways is as hard as doing like medium-sized things. You know, that could be harder in some ways, because what you find is when you work on something like really big, really hard, but man, if you achieve it, it could be a really big deal. The universe almost like conspires to help you make it work. And you have so many of these uplifting, helpful things in society that are just built in to lift you up and help you. And if you're doing a medium-sized thing, you don't necessarily have that. So, you know, people have this perception of like, oh man, going after big things, that's way harder. I don't know if I want to do that. And, you know, by the way, early on in your career, maybe you do need a stepping stone to get to this point. Like maybe this isn't the thing that happens right away. But eventually, like the bigger you go, the more help that you get. And I think that that's something that some people should really embrace. And yeah, working together with great people and, you know, embracing that like universe conspiring to make something great happen. That's kind of how great things happen. And you just have to be open to that and you have to pursue it.
I like that because it's kind of counterintuitive. You're like, oh, it should be easier to build a small to mid-sized business. But sometimes, like I think Dan Sullivan says, 10X is easier than 2X, right? Where it's like, if you have a 10X vision, you can attract 10X people, right? If you have a small mid-sized vision, it's not going to attract a talent because they want to work on really hard, exciting challenges. Investors want to work on things that are going to change the world with crazy upside. And so the bigger idea you have, one, the more inspiration you have, that energy gets transmitted out to the universe and the right people, circumstances come together to help you achieve it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Steve Jobs was very famous for one of the ways he used to inspire people, and this happened with engineers sometimes or partners they'd have. So he'd just go up to them and he'd say, you can do this. Like, you can actually do this. And, you know, I guess message for whoever's listening to this, like, you can do it. Like, you can absolutely do that. Do whatever you want. Like, it's possible. All the things that were created in the world were created from people like you that just had big visions and went after things. So you can absolutely do it. And I think also having that like belief in yourself gives you permission and the ability to go after that.
Powerful words. Two last questions for you. We'll let you get out of here. Number one, how do you define a world-class entrepreneur? What does that mean to you?
I think some of the best entrepreneurs that I've worked with and we've worked with, it's some combination of like curiosity, raw intelligence, but combined with like the ability to break through walls, persistence, tenacity, just like not taking no for an answer. I think that that's really important. Like giving it your all, like showing up for game day with everything and just going. I'd say there's like generally two modes of people you find in the world, which is a kind of interesting way to think about the world. There's like the people who play offense every day, and there's the people who play defense every day. The people who play defense every day, you're commanded by things like your inbox, what's coming up on your calendar, things people are telling you have to do, etc. The people who play offense are the people that are like, here are the three most important things that matter. I'm going to write them down. And by the end of the day, I'm going to try to do all three. And if I don't do them, I'm going to do two. And then by tomorrow, I'm going to do the other one. And those people, those are like the relentless people that get what they want from the world, that are the people you want to partner with and that you want to be working with. And some people have that naturally. Some people it's unnatural. They kind of need to like reprogram themselves a little bit, but it's absolutely doable to reprogram yourself to do that. And those are the people that we look for and we like partnering with. And it's a lot of fun to work with people like that because you're doing great things and you're making moves every day.
I love that definition. Before I ask my last question, where can our audience find you online, engage with you?
Two great places would be just Twitter. I think it's just Jack Abraham, and LinkedIn, which I think is also just Jack Abraham. Mm-hmm. Would love to engage with anyone.
Awesome. And then last question here. I think to be world-class is to constantly strive for your next level, right? It's to constantly pursue growth. There's no dead end to it. It's to seek expansion, to keep building things. For you, after everything you've built, what does your next level look like?
Yeah, I'm I continue to be inspired by, you know, the Elons of the world and the Sam Altmans of the world, picking off like really, really, really big, hard problems and going after those and just putting a lot behind them of intensity, focus, talent, you know, all the things that make those things work. And we're pursuing some really big, exciting, like visionary things today at Atomic, which is really exciting. So I think part of it is that. And then I think part of it is just continuing on this process that we've been on of how do you build the company that builds companies and make that as successful and scalable as possible and spawn some incredible game-changing companies along the way. I think I have a big privilege of working at Atomic because I like to think with any individual startup company or kind of given the privilege of innovating in an industry and disrupting it, in some ways what we're doing is we're doing the second derivative of that. We're innovating and disrupting the process by which companies are created. So yes. By innovating on innovation itself, it's one of the hardest problems in the world to solve, but it is also one of the most valuable, and I enjoy it every day. And, you know, hopefully, you know, if anyone's listening, we love working with great people. So if you want to be a part of that, I like to think like I'm so lucky because I created my dream job somehow. And now I'm happy that I get to share it with other people.
Thank you so much, Jake. This is, I mean, you are so inspiring as an entrepreneur. You're so down to earth. And you would never guess that you've built all the things you've done when you talk. You're just such a down to earth guy. So thanks for just being the founder's founder, you know, just a champion of others, for giving back, for being a leader in the Miami ecosystem, putting us on the map. So it's been a blast. Thanks for coming.
Of course. Thanks for having me. This has been great.
Sweet. Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the World Class Podcast. Don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe across all our platforms. Hit that notification bell so you can get updates on our new episodes. And we'll see you next week.